Hi everyone, welcome to the Live Longer World podcast. I am your host, Astha Jain. On this podcast, I have conversations with scientists and entrepreneurs that are transforming the field of longevity science. If you wish to stay notified of upcoming podcast releases and sign up for my newsletter, head over to livelongerworld.com. And if you want to receive extensive show notes and transcripts from each episode, you can sign up to be a premium member at livelongerworld.com/premium. My guest today is Andy Lee, who is the Chief Operating Officer at Vincere Biosciences. Vincere is working to stop Parkinson's disease by creating small molecules or drugs that target mitochondrial dysfunction. There's increasing evidence that a dysfunctional mitochondria can lead to the onset of Parkinson's disease. So in today's conversation, we spoke about the science behind a dysfunctional mitochondria, the relationship between the mitochondria and Parkinson's disease. We also discussed certain supplements like urolithin A or CoQ10 that could possibly boost the mitochondria and maybe stop Parkinson's disease, or perhaps not. We also discussed what it's like to run a biotech company and technology or computational biology and AI systems that can be used to screen drugs and targets and simulate a cell environment. Andy comes from a technology and computer science background, and he's combined it with neuroscience and biology to create Vincere Biosciences. So I hope you enjoy today's conversation.
Hi, Andy, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you today.
Thanks, Asma. It's great to be here.
So, Andy, your company, Vincere Biosciences, is working on creating small molecules and drugs to stop Parkinson's disease by targeting the mitochondria and the dysfunction in the mitochondria. I do want to discuss the science a little later, but perhaps maybe you can explain what Vincere is doing and how it even came about.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Vincere is a Latin term, which means to win or to conquer. And so, you know, right off when we formed the company, we wanted that constant reminder that this is a fight, that we're champions for patients. There are people who are, you know, looking for somebody to, you know, get drugs into the clinic that can stop the progression of this disease. That's kind of our guiding force, is trying to win this fight to improve the lives of patients. That's the key. And, you know, my background is as a computer scientist, and my co-founder is my wife, who's a neuroscientist. And so we have this kind of unique blend of these two disciplines that, you know, came together, started a while back, about 7 years ago. We thought, you know, how can we put these together to try to come up with drug targets that are actually going to work? How can we make drugs that don't fail in phase two clinical trial for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other neurodegenerative disease? And, you know, I had been previously, I was in fintech building high performance computing and automation applications for the mortgage and banking industry. And think about how we can take some of that data integration and AI processing and apply it to the biospace, where there's less, you know, application of those right now. And that was kind of the genesis of starting to build tools and start to look into the complex processes of neurodegeneration and come up with better targets. And then about 3 years ago, we had, you know, a really good idea of where we wanted to go from a drug perspective, and started Vincere to do the small molecule development. The focus on mitochondria, you know, really is driven by human genetics at the core. If you look at a disease like Parkinson's, where, you know, most of the cases are idiopathic, they don't have a genetic basis, mm-hmm. but you don't have a lot of really clues as to what's going on in the disease course. If you know, we know that there are these motor symptoms, and that in the postmortem you've got, you know, loss of the specific nigrostriatal dopamine neuron subset, and you've got aggregates of Lewy bodies. But all of that is kind of, you know, end state. And so you don't know what's the progression to get there. And you don't know which of those things might be side effects as opposed to causative features. But in human genetics, we know there are a set of mutations that cause the disease, like, not fully penetrant, any of them, but, if you get these mutations, it can lead to the disease. And in the case of Parkinson's, one of the neat things is there are about a dozen Mendelian genes that cause Parkinson's. And so from that, we can start to triangulate on the commonalities, where do they overlap, to prioritize which pathway. And if you look at any of them individually, they seem to be kind of disconnected. About half of them are directly involved in mitophagy and mitochondrial quality control, like PINK1, Parkin, and FBXO7, some of the others in that pathway. And then, the rest seem to be involved in a variety of things like lysosomal function or endolysosomal trafficking, things like that. But when we start to look at if you look at the pathway context, if you like think about each of these genes encodes a protein that has some function in the cell and has a finite set of interactors that it might, interact with to do something. If you then, go out a few steps from each of those and start to look at the overlap of all of those genetic communities, you see that they all converge on mitochondrial quality control. So that's where that's the most highly overrepresented pathway within the set of biological pathways that are impacted by these mutations. So that was our big, like, if we can increase mitophagy or increase mitochondrial quality mechanisms, there's a really good chance that it's going to help a really broad group of Parkinson's patients. Leads us to the next kind of interesting thing of age is the biggest risk factor for Parkinson's, and declining mitochondrial quality is one of the hallmarks of aging. And so now we're like, okay, well, this is a really cool intersection, right? If you can see these mechanisms of human disease that are also hallmarks of aging, maybe now we have the ability to, get an even bigger benefit than helping this patient population.
Absolutely. So what you're saying, by targeting the mitochondria, we can possibly help patients with Parkinson's, but also patients who are suffering other age-related diseases, because it's one of the hallmarks of aging. So one thing you mentioned was how mitochondrial quality control is the common factor when it comes to Parkinson's disease. And you mentioned a few maybe enzymes or factors, some of them being PINK1, Parkin, I think USP30 is one you mentioned in the science as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you can explain the interrelation and the science of the mechanism behind what's happening with mitophagy and Parkin and USP30, what's going on that you found out through the science?
Yeah, so mitochondria naturally become damaged and dysfunctional through a variety of things. There may be toxins or just the normal life cycle of a mitochondria is about 45 days or so. And so when the mitochondria become dysfunctional, the membrane becomes depolarized. And when that happens, they start to produce a lot of reactive oxygen species that has other problems. They don't produce ATP as efficiently as they're supposed to. So having dysfunctional mitochondria hanging out in the cell is really bad. And that's also something that has been implicated to lead to cellular senescence or increased inflammation, other downstream things from that. But when so there's a natural quality control mechanism that's built in to the cell. And so when the cell becomes depolarized, there's an enzyme called PINK1 that that comes to the mitochondria at what's called the translocase or the TOM complex. And this is a channel that goes from the outside to the inside of the mitochondrial matrix. And when if PINK1 binds to that channel, it just gets quickly sucked through and cleaved and broken down. When the mitochondria are depolarized, it sticks to the TOM enzyme or channel on the outside and then doesn't get pulled through. So when you start to get a bunch of PINK1 accumulating on the outside of these mitochondria, which then PINK1 is a kinase that will phosphorylate ubiquitin that is on the outer mitochondrial proteins. And then that phosphoubiquitin is a signal for parkin, which is an E3 ligase, to come and bind to the mitochondria, which then has this big feed-forward loop where parkin will add polyubiquitin chains to the outside of these damaged mitochondria. And once that happens, those chains of polyubiquitin are a signal for the autophagosome machinery to come in and engulf the mitochondria, take it off to the lysosome for breakdown and recycling. That also triggers increase of PGC1 alpha and mitochondrial biogenesis. So you get this like kind of double benefit of clean up the bad ones, make new ones, that happens there. And USP30 is a deubiquitinating enzyme. So for really every process in the system, there's a yin and a yang, there's a counterpoint. So for kinases, there are phosphatases that take those phosphor tags off. For E3 ligases that add ubiquitin tags, there are deubiquitinating enzymes that remove those. USP30 is a really special one because it's always resident on the mitochondrial outer membrane. So it doesn't have to be recruited. And being there, it's constantly like trying to remove ubiquitin tags and really sets like a quality quality control threshold for PINK1. You can imagine if USP30 is very active, then you have no ubiquitin. So even when PINK1 starts to accumulate, it doesn't have anything to phosphorylate. So it takes longer to initiate that damage recognition signal. If you can inhibit USP30, then you'll have more baseline ubiquitin on the outer membrane. So that can happen more quickly. USP30 also counteracts parkin substrates. And so it'll take those chains off as they're being put on. So that's the idea. If you want to increase mitophagy, you could increase parkin activity so that it can add those chains more quickly. You could inhibit USP30 so it removes those chains more slowly. And either of those will lead to increased mitophagy and clearance, specifically of damaged mitochondria, right? And that's really important. Like, we want to increase mitophagy, but not clearance of healthy mitochondria, only the damaged mitochondria. So right now we have active small molecule programs that with compounds that can increase parkin activity and compounds that can inhibit USP30. And we're carrying forward both of those paths toward the clinic.
So the way I understand is that for Parkinson's disease patients, the parkin activity is reduced, which means the process of mitophagy or clearing away damaged mitochondria is happening at a much slower rate, and or USP30 activity is increased. So it's inhibiting the clearance of damaged mitochondria. Is that a good way to think about it?
In some of the patients, so one of the mutations in parkin do reduce parkin activity, and that can lead to Parkinson's disease. But there are more than a direct inhibition of mitophagy. There are other factors that cause mitochondrial damage. If you look at some of the other mutations that aren't directly involved in mitophagy, such as GBA is a lysosomal enzyme where mutations can increase risk for Parkinson's. And while it doesn't directly impact this mitophagy process, if you look within patient-derived cells with this mutation, you still see reduced levels of mitophagy. So some of the biology is a little more complex than just directly increased USP30 activity or decreased parkin activity, and maybe downstream of the others. We also see alpha-synuclein, which is the primary component of the Lewy body aggregates. The toxic forms of alpha-synuclein also preferentially bind to mitochondria and cause depolarization of the mitochondria. So that starts to then, you can see where even if you don't have a direct dysfunctional mitophagy mechanism, if you start to get this feedforward process where you get synuclein aggregates from maybe some other cause, they're gonna start to cause further mitochondrial damage And then even a normal baseline, healthy level of mitophagy isn't enough to keep up with the increased demand from this synuclein damage.
Right? Interesting. So, I see. Yeah. So is there, do you know why there's this synuclein damage that ends up happening?
Yeah. What is causing the synuclein damage and aggregation in the first place? I don't know. I know, there are triplication mutations in synuclein that can lead to Parkinson's disease. So if you have too much synuclein, it can start to aggregate and cause this problem. Other factors like why do you get synuclein aggregates downstream of some of these others? I don't know the mechanism on those. And I think some of that is still under research. It's amazing. In this disease, and I think in most diseases, there's a lot that the world still is yet to learn.
100%. So much of, I think, the research going on right now is that, especially when I talk to some of the other guests, like, we know that this targets this, but we don't really know why it's happening or the mechanism by which something is working. It's always interesting to ask people and see what they think might be happening, though.
Right.
Yeah. So I do want to talk about USP30 a little bit, because there's one thing you mentioned, that it is possibly inhibiting Parkin activity, and maybe that's happening more so in people with Parkinson's disease. But I'm sure it plays a beneficial role in the human body as well, and it sounds like maybe mitochondrial quality is one of those roles. Maybe if you can talk to what is the role it plays in the mitochondria, and then perhaps why does it end up becoming, maybe call it more hyperactive with age, if we know anything about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So beyond opposing Parkin and kind of being, I think in some cases these corresponding enzymes like USP30 are there just to make sure you don't get a runaway of some other process. And so there's kind of the brakes to that, just to keep it in check so that you you have the right flux balance of an activity. But then there are some emerging things with USP30 as well, where deubiquitinating some proteins changes their behavior. Ubiquitination isn't just a signal for degradation, it's also a signal for other activity changes. A few of these, for some proteins that are nuclear encoded but then have to be imported to the mitochondria, deubiquitination is a step that allows them to then pass through the TOM complex. Paper recently came out showing that USP30 deubiquitinates NLRP3 and therefore activates the inflammasome. So inhibiting USP30 may reduce inflammation through that path. It's also been shown in a model of hepatocellular carcinoma to have a deubiquitination that impacts the ACLY processing as well. So I think there are some others. It seems to be generally beneficial in quality control. Kind of some of these stress sensing or stress response mechanisms across a few different places.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like it is playing a role in a bunch of different things. I think there was another paper that it helps with something like oxygen glucose regulation as well. I can add the link to that. I was just curious that, I'm sure it plays a beneficial role in terms of quality control, because otherwise I would think nature would select against it. But there's probably similar to a lot of other activities happening in the body. Something seems to go haywire with age and then it ends up being more damaging than beneficial.
Right. And there are some things in these pathways that do trend with age. If you look at like cardiac function, parkin expression starts to decrease in the heart and age. And so you get decreased mitophagy, which then seems to lead to cardiac aging. And actually, was recently shown that USP30 knockdown can reduce cellular senescence in myocardial cells and in the heart.
Interesting.
So, right, seeing some benefit toward heart there. Hepatocellular carcinoma, in the liver, they showed that USP30 is upregulated in tumor cells. So maybe looking at mechanisms of the progression there. But again, USP30 knockout showed protection and reduced tumor formation in those models. So there are places where we do see transcriptional changes in tissue along with age or disease, where you see decreases of PINK1 or parkin or increases of USP30 that throw this off into one of those bad states that we want to try to correct for.
Yeah, you mentioned myocardia, because I guess with COVID-19 or the vaccine, there are some cases of younger men, especially getting myocarditis. Is there, do you know if there's any link between USP30 or myocarditis there?
I don't. I haven't looked into that. That's an interesting question of whether that might play a part there.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm also just curious in general, like why it affects younger men in general, and maybe I don't know if USP30 has any role to play out there.
Yeah, I don't know what the mechanism of that is, or where it I'm the different types of vaccines and how they're interacting and where they're interacting are all interesting mechanisms. Not areas that I've dug into deeply, though.
So in terms of the small molecules or the drugs that you're developing, have you tested any of these possibly in animals or any trials that are going on in humans? What's the stage you're at?
Yeah, we're in preclinical development optimization right now, working through pharmacodynamics and efficacy models in vivo at the moment on these. And we're kind of fortunate that the field is also gathering interest in this pathway. So we're seeing some data come out from other groups. The two USP30 studies I just talked about with heart and liver. In Parkinson's, USP30 inhibition was recently shown to restore mitophagy deficits in parkin mutation carrier iPSCs. So looking at human-derived stem cells that are where you can see the patient cells have these deficits, and USP30 can correct that, which is exciting. Animal models have not been terribly predictive of efficacy in neurodegeneration. So as we see with amyloid in the Alzheimer's world and things that have been tried previously for Parkinson's, like a lot of things can look promising in an artificial system in a mouse, but mice don't get Alzheimer's, mice don't get Parkinson's. None of the models recapitulate all of the factors of disease. So you really have to, that's why we, from a hypothesis perspective, go back to human genetics and make our, kind of make our hypothesis on what's going to be effective there. And then we look at the preclinical development really more around, safety and target engagement and looking at that in vivo. But the human stem cells are interesting platforms, but also imperfect, right? So you've now epigenetically reset these cells, and now you've got young patient cells that have some abnormality, but they're not really the old brain cells that get the disease in humans. They're also in isolation and lacking. Maybe it's not stem cells. Maybe it's not dopamine neurons. No matter how you differentiate that, you're lacking a part of the context of surrounding not clear or whatever, right?
No, absolutely. I'm sure there are just so many factors that play a role. Like, as you just mentioned, when you were describing the connection between mitochondria and Parkinson's, seems like it's not just, you know, parking a USB 30, they're just nucleic acid or other factors that are also going on in there. We discussed a bit on the mitochondria. Well, in case there's anything else you want to talk about the connection between mitochondria and Parkinson's, I want to ask you maybe what were some of the other pathways that you observed that have been implicated in causing Parkinson's disease? I know mitochondria is one that you mentioned. Everything seemed to converge on the mitochondria. This is why y'all chose it as the target. But what were some of the other ones?
Yeah, there are a handful of emerging or you know, compelling hypotheses in Parkinson's. Inflammation is gathering a lot of buzz, and I think rightfully so. There's some there's increased inflammation there, and you know, whether it's causative or downstream, you could certainly see where the inflammation seen in disease could be downstream of mitochondrial damage. So that may be there. The synuclein disaggregation approach, or just reduction, may play a factor in most patients. Synuclein is, a part of the disease process. So whether that's midstream or causative is unknown, but that's a hypothesis, really worth following. There are a couple of genetic cohorts that are pretty large with GBA mutation carriers and LRRK2 mutation carriers. Both of those, where you have that mutation with a clear enzymatic function that you can modulate, I think certainly for those cohorts that opens up a possibility. And there are trials underway for that with Denali Therapeutics has a LRRK2 inhibitor that is being tried now, and a couple of groups going after gene therapy or small molecule stabilizers of GBA for that. ER stress is another area that is interesting, but I think has a lot of pathway complexity that has maybe makes that challenging from a drugability and assay design perspective.
So for the GBA one though, that would probably only work in people who get Parkinson's through genetically, right?
That's the certainly where the groups developing those drugs or gene therapies are focusing first at those cohorts. But it's interesting, some of the interplay, if you have reduced, there's an inverse relationship between GCase, which is the protein encoded by GBA, between GCase activity and synuclein levels. So if you have impaired or reduced GCase, you end up with increased synuclein, which then might lead to the synuclein aggregates. But you also have, if you have reduced synuclein, you have increased GCase activity. So there's something feeding back there that it's possible that that where you have these patients that have Parkinson's coming from one of these other cases where they have increased synuclein from some other cause, then are going to have reduced GCase activity. And if you increase GCase activity, maybe that helps. Like if the root cause or central problem of Parkinson's turns out to be lysosomal function and the dysregulation of the enzymes there, and increasing GBA might overcome that even for other causes. I think for any of these cases that are going after one, there are some, there's potential that they may apply to broader populations.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. It sounded like the way y'all approached it was also similar, where you look at maybe some of the genetic targets and see how you can reproduce like the beneficial part of it or counter the genetic aspect of it in patients who don't get it genetically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's going to be really important. And there's a balance in, as you're thinking through the strategy on, how do you get a drug to patients? you want to define as kind of as small and homogeneous population of patients as possible so that you can have a high likelihood of success in your first clinical trial to show that the drug is actually, you know, doing something. But then also want to have an approach that may apply to, you know, all patients. You know, it's a very small percentage of patients that have a genetic cause. Most are idiopathic. And so, you know, I think everybody's hoping to get something that can apply to the broad cohort. But, you know, I think if you can start with that genetically defined group, I think that can be really helpful.
Yeah, fantastic. So you come from a computer science background, as I think you briefly mentioned. And I believe Vincere also came out of Neuro Initiative, which is this other company I think you started to use technology to cure some of the diseases of aging. And you also did mention how you use some of this technology to screen for targets such that drugs don't fail in clinical trials. I'm just curious, how does that technology work? How does that side of computational biology work? Like, what are the tools you're using?
Yeah, there are quite a few that we've applied throughout the way. You know, as mentioned, we started with Neuro Initiative, and the idea there was to you know, really take a mechanistic view and break down the cellular biology and see if we can figure out how to connect the dots between the things we know and fill in the gaps of the things we don't know. And we started with a biological simulation platform that blends particle physics with protein-protein interaction rules. So if you can think about a cell is made up of membrane-bound compartments that have that are packed full of some number of biochemical entities, and each of those biochemical entities has a known, you know, shape and size and set of interactors. You know, in a lot of cases, we know what they bind to, we know some of the things that they interact with, and within that space, we know the, you know, Newtonian or Brownian laws of motion that kind of describe the way they move within that space. So if you look at multiomic data, transcriptomics, proteomics, lipidomics, and you know, kind of from that get a perspective on the quantities of biochemical entities, have the kind of the copy number of each of them that are within a cellular space, use physics to allow them to move freely within that environment, and then look at taking a rule-based approach for when proteins interact, what do they do? If it's a kinase, it's going to, you know, take, you know, phosphorylate the substrate, and, you know, then it's going to go off and have to load up with ATP and then come back and do it again, right? If it's, you know, something that forms a larger complex, they're going to meet a partner and bind up, and now they're going to go and try to find the next partner to keep assembling until they get this bigger piece of machinery. Some things are like the TOM complex are channels where something will bind to it, and then if the state is right, it'll pass through, and if the state is not, it'll stay there till the state changes and then pass through, right? So by blending multi-omics with particle physics with interaction rule libraries, we're able to simulate a virtual cell. And then we can, from there, take the different omics profiles, and we can say, okay, now I want to look at the transcriptomics from a Parkinson's patient substantia nigra cell, and then look at a substantia nigra cell from a healthy control that's age-matched, and see what are the differences, and how do these simulated cells behave differently? And when you do that, you can start to see, you know, the Parkinson's brain cell is deficient in mitophagy, and if you increase Parkin in that virtual cell, you can make it respond like the healthy, right? So we use that to test and do target validation to really understand that modulating these targets in the system that we actually want to affect are actually going to work. That was one of the key areas we started with first, and from there have gone into other protein interaction network-based approaches, protein ligand virtual screening to try to get compounds that can engage the targets that we want to work with, multi-omic modeling, getting into some of the like AI ML type modeling to look at signatures of Parkinson's patients or for progression of disease as well.
That's super cool. I think next time I'll have to ask you to share your screen and give a demo of that platform. I'd like to see how the different cells actually interact in this platform. But that's a really interesting because, I think some of the questions obviously humans and scientists ask, but a lot of the ways the pathways connect and how proteins interact with each other, if we can actually use technology to make it easier for us, just is probably quite helpful.
Yeah. There's so much data emerging out there with, if you look at OnGeo for data sets of across humans or look at the transcriptomic data sets or methylation data sets, and you can start to take all of this and mass and start to build models of a variety of different disease states. And if you look on platforms like BioGrid or others with protein interactions, they're just exploding so quickly in volume, not to mention all of the billions of papers that are published that haven't yet made it into those repositories. So I think there's no way you can keep up with the state of the art in this field without some form of computational automation.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So are there are some supplements and drugs, I guess, that have been shown to have beneficial effects on the mitochondria? Say, I think Urolithin A might be one, mm-hmm. CoQ10. I'm curious if there's any data that shows that perhaps they might be beneficial in treating Parkinson's disease as well, now that you've explained this mechanism between mitochondrial dysfunction and Parkinson's. I believe there were some study that came out that CoQ10 is not effective, but I'm sure you know better.
Yeah, those are certainly interesting. And in the case of CoQ10, I think one of the challenges is brain penetration. I think that the molecule there has been shown to not cross the blood-brain barrier. So you just may not be getting to a site of action with that one. Urolithin A in the person, I don't know, if it's been studied heavily enough to show the distribution. I don't think they've gotten through, properly powered pure, placebo controlled trials to show, that it can, that whether it's beneficial or not. Also with the natural substances like that, people have shown in the lab that it can increase mitophagy, but I'm not sure we know the mechanism of that or what else it may be doing. So I think there may be some concerns or caveats there. But yeah, I think those are certainly interesting. I think Urolithin A in particular, caught my eye, and I drink a lot more pomegranate juice now. I liked it anyway, but I'm like, okay, sure, maybe that's a good way. I think those are interesting things. I think with something like that, though, there's also, you run into incentive questions around who's going to pay for the long multi-year, properly powered placebo controlled trial for Parkinson's disease for a natural substance that they're not going to have, any patents on and ability to recoup those costs. I think that is a, unfortunate state of the world of how having to balance that. I also wonder within the, whether there can be some real world evidence that starts to emerge around something like that. I think that one, the Parkinson's community has got to know, and maybe people are starting to take it more heavily. But I don't know that it's been shown well enough. One of the things that we're really focused on right now is biomarker discovery to really show that you're increasing mitophagy in in humans, in mice even, like how do you measure mitophagy and whether it's increasing? It's such a dynamic process as far as like the timing of the events and or mitochondrial health. Maybe you can step back from mitophagy and say mitochondrial health as well. And so I think for some of those, and if we can make it easier to measure, we might be able to then look at some of these other substances without having to have such a expensive trial.
Absolutely. Are there any biomarkers you're aware of that are emerging specifically for the mitochondria?
Yeah, some that have been reported in the mice, there are some really cool things that are available now with a couple of reporters that have been recently developed, one called Mitokyma and another called MitoQC. Both they're slightly different, but both of them tag the mitochondria with a fluorescent tag that changes wavelength when it goes into the acidic environment of the lysosome. So that had been done in cells for a while, but now there have been transgenic mouse lines developed with these, so you can visualize the extent of mitophagy in vivo. Obviously, still with that you're taking a single time point because you have to collect the brains to measure that, which is so you can't get that time series of what's actually happening. But then you can't use that in a human, obviously. So the next thing you're looking at markers. So you can look at the TOM complex that is transmembrane and doesn't get degraded through other mechanisms than mitophagy, has been shown to be a reliable measure of mitophagy that correlates well with those others. So some of those things I think you can may translate well into the clinic. And so we're looking at, what are the direct substrates of Parkin and USB30, and what are the other mitochondrial components that are always there when they're until they're degraded. There are a few options that fit that. Looking at mitochondrial health in terms of ATP production or ATP to ADP ratios or some of the others that are, I think may translate. So I think there's some things that are emerging, but it's definitely an early field.
That's exciting, though. I'm very excited for better biomarkers to come out so we can actually start measuring and tracking some of these things.
Yeah, definitely.
On the flip side of mitophagy, is there such a thing as maybe too much mitophagy that people suffer from? I think one thing you also mentioned was that you want to be careful about only damaging the damaged mitochondria, not the or clearing away the damaged mitochondria, not the healthy mitochondria. Is there something that maybe people suffer from when there's too much mitochondrial turnover, too much mitophagy?
If there are any natural diseases that are mediated through too much mitophagy, that's an interesting question. I know that is a concern with modulating this pathway. We want to make sure that we're not overactivating, because you can, in the lab, you can do things that, clear all the mitochondria, and if you have no mitochondria, that's bad. So you wouldn't want that. And that's where, we prioritize targets that are downstream of the cell's natural signal of mitochondrial damage, and then look at comparisons of levels of mitophagy with our drug at a baseline level, and then in the presence of some mitochondrial damaging agent, and show that we're clearing damaged mitochondria much more quickly than clearing healthy mitochondria. So I think it's, we can do things like that to make sure that we're not clearing healthy mitochondria with our compounds. But it is interesting question of whether there are any diseases that are actually causing a runaway mitophagy on that side.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So in terms of just, I guess, running a biotech company, what are maybe some of the challenges, biggest challenges you face? And maybe the optimistic question is, what do you want to be improved in the future that would just make, maybe make testing some of these drugs or molecules or just running a biotech company or more biotech companies to emerge just a much smoother process?
Yeah, running a biotech company is challenging, and maybe any high tech, hard tech company is like this, because you're constantly juggling fundraising and doing the science and HR management and logistics and legal and all of that. So there's so many pieces to play. And in the early days, you know, as a founder, you're doing all of those things until you get cross thresholds that you can start to bring in people. And, you know, even when you get to larger teams that are very good at doing pieces of that, I think you still have to stay fairly deep into those to, you can't make the right strategic IP decisions unless you have some understanding of medicinal chemistry and where your compounds are going, and like really fact checking and validating that your team has put together patents that cover the right space. And you can't really raise capital effectively unless you can translate and speak the finance language and really understand what the, you know, cost and earnings and P&L are going to look like and what the financial projections are, and make estimates on timeline that you can't do unless you understand the experimental design and how long it's really going to take to, you know, breed an animal colony to do whatever, right? So there are all these pieces that you have to track. So I think that's it's one of the, you know, challenges as a founder. And, you know, within the whole industry, you know, I think the trying to bring together talent and capital and ideas is a hard problem. And we see, you know, a lot of ways to approach this, from venture funds that are doing venture creation, you know, where they've got the capital and talent, and then they just look for ideas and they internally make it and they go, or founders that, you know, have some really hard technical skill and they've got some idea to do something, but then they've got to go and try to get somebody to fund it. And, you know, everyone's kind of got a piece of it. And then to something like, you know, Altos Labs, that is now saying, we're going to give enough money that people don't have to worry about it. We're going to just buy the best and the brightest people and put them together and, you know, really build the backlog of hard problems for them to solve. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see which of these experiments to like do that will pan out. I ultimately think, you know, the more people working on these problems, the better, you know, and each of the ways that you can go about that are, you know, they may work. Any of them have merit. So that's, it'd be interesting to see that play out.
100%. Just more shots in gold, more smart people working on it. Amazing. So we've discussed a bit on just mitochondrial disease, Parkinson's, understand some of the I guess relationship between the two much better now. Bit about your company too. Is there anything else that maybe we haven't covered and you want to discuss?
I think just you know, excited to see the progress and path forward. It's, you know, we're eager to get these into the clinic at this point. You know, we have compounds that, you know, we know are highly selective and have, you know, great activity to increase mitophagy in human neurons. They have good PK profile. They're well tolerated in animals and safe to carry through. So, you know, it's one of these where, you know, the next couple of years are going to be extremely exciting to carry these into the clinic. And so we're looking forward to that road, and look forward to sharing good news over the next year.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, thank you for that. We're also looking forward to it.
Cool. Yeah, this was a great conversation. Thanks for having me today.
Hi again, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the episode and learned from it. If so, please show some support by subscribing to my YouTube channel, Live Longer World, liking the video, sharing the podcast, and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to dive into these topics further and receive extensive show notes and transcripts from each episode, you can sign up to be a premium subscriber at livelongerworld.com/premium. To be notified of upcoming podcast releases, sign up on my website at livelongerworld.com. Follow me on Twitter at livelongerworld and Instagram at longevityfuture. Thanks for listening. Stay in good health, and I'll catch you soon.